Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Like it's the start of something really big, a movement of the people for liberation of Palestine.
I think Jewish pride is very high right now. We're very proud and we're very united as a community, but that's directly because we feel abandoned by everyone else.
Pro-Palestinian encampments remain set up at Canadian universities. Protesters say they're staying put until their divestment demands are met, while south of the border, police move in again. Welcome to Your World Tonight on Saturday, May 4th. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. Also on the podcast, a New Brunswick school district challenges the province over its gender identity policy, taking the fight to the courts. And
I'm fired up for Game 7, and all I know, we got momentum now. Leafs in 7!
They've been here before, but swear this time is different. The Leafs versus the Bruins, Game 7, do or die. We'll set up tonight's game and the upcoming battle for Western Canada supremacy. Pro-Palestinian protests on university campuses in Canada and the U.S. show no signs of stopping. In the U.S., police have disrupted a protest at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, coming days after scenes of violence at Columbia University in New York City and UCLA in Los Angeles. On a number of Canadian campuses, protesters are refusing to move their tents, but university administrations are not forcing them to leave yet. Philip Lee Shannock reports.
Demonstrators at a pro-Palestinian protest at McGill University in downtown Montreal are staying put.
I feel like it's the start of something really big, a movement of the people.
As the protest camp stretches into its eighth day, organizer Rima Kerzat says this was the first campus in Canada where students made a stand.
It kind of makes me proud to be from Montreal, but I think like the movement is bigger than just us in Montreal. It's in the United States, it's here in Canada, it's over there in Europe.
The protesters are demanding that the school cut ties with Israel. McGill officials have said they're open to talks with the demonstrators, but only if they take down their encampment. This week, a Quebec Superior Court judge rejected a request for an injunction that would have forced them to leave. Lawyer Neil Oberman argued that McGill is not keeping its campus safe.
My two clients, who are simple students, shouldn't have to have engaged an attorney to go to court in order to protect their rights.
At the University of Toronto, it's the second day of a protest camp. And while the administration says the activities are unauthorized, it has not called in police to remove the protesters. Ahmad Ayesh says they won't leave.
The people here are hardened. They believe in supporting this cause. I think that they're willing to stay for as long as it takes.
I'm here to stop hate speech.
Sharon Bar-David joined a counter-protest outside the fenced-in encampment. She says the administration should order it dismantled.
Suddenly at 4 a.m., everyone came. Where was the university? Is that all the strategy they can offer?
Police moved in this week, dismantling encampments at New York's Columbia University and UCLA in Los Angeles. Harini Sivalinga is a lawyer with the Canadian Civil Liberties Association.
Any, like, you know, limitations or use of force, such as, you know, police to try to dismantle these types of really protected speech and engagement is concerning.
She says here in Canada, demonstrations are protected expressions of free speech, unless they turn violent or pose a threat to security.
So if you look back at the involvement of student-led protests against the war in Vietnam, the apartheid in South Africa, it was students that were the forefront of this.
This week, U.S. President Joe Biden reiterated that while peaceful protest is legal, violence, vandalism, shutting down campuses and canceling graduations will not be tolerated. Philip Shannock, CBC News, Toronto.
In Israel, there are also protests. Demonstrators in Tel Aviv calling for their government to bring Israeli hostages home. Talks to do just that are happening now in Cairo, with negotiators from Hamas, Egypt, Qatar, and the U.S. working to hammer out a deal that could also see a pause in the war. After months of stops and starts, talks appear to be at a critical point. Chris Reyes has more on that.
More Israeli airstrikes, more deaths in Gaza as negotiators attempt another ceasefire deal. A Hamas delegation is now meeting with U.S., Egyptian and Qatari officials in Cairo, among them CIA Director Bill Burns. Secretary of State Antony Blinken placed all responsibility for peace in the hands of Hamas.
The only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas.
Some of the issues on the negotiating table include the release of some Israeli hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, a temporary ceasefire, and staving off an Israeli offensive in Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering. Aaron Miller is a former negotiator with the U.S. State Department.
In my experience, these negotiations usually have two speeds, slow and slower. At the same time, I think we're probably closer now than we've ever been before.
Gershon Baskin is a hostage negotiator based in Jerusalem. He says he's looking for one indication that the negotiations are productive.
If we see in the coming hours or days an Israeli senior delegation going to Cairo, we will know that there is forward movement and this is being taken seriously.
In Tel Aviv, more protests demanding that the Israeli government reach a deal to release the hostages. Michael Levy, whose brother was taken on October 7, says he doesn't want to get his hopes up.
Until this is real and until I will see hostages actually coming back, I won't think about it too much.
Pressure is mounting on Israel to end the war as the situation in Gaza grows more dire by the day. While there hasn't been an official declaration, the head of the UN's World Food Program, Cindy McCain, says the northern part of the enclave is now in a full-blown famine that's quickly spreading to the south.
It's so hard to look at and it's so hard to hear also. I'm so hoping that we can get a ceasefire and begin to feed these people in a much faster fashion.
It's believed that more than 100 hostages are still being held in Gaza by Hamas, but how many of those hostages are still alive is not known. According to the UN, more than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed since Israel launched its military offensive into the enclave. Chris Reyes, CBC News, New York.
India is reacting today to the arrest of three men for the murder of a Sikh activist in BC. Hardeep Singh Nijjar was shot outside a Sikh temple in Surrey last year. India's foreign minister, Subramaniam Jaishankar, says he is waiting to hear more information about the suspects, who are all Indian citizens. But he suggests Canada is to blame for allowing people with ties to gangs into the country.
We have been telling Canada, saying, look, these are wanted criminals from India. You have given them visas. They have come, many of them, in false documentation. And yet you allow them to live there. If you decide to import for political purposes people with very dubious, actually very negative background, there will be issues. If something happened there, it is for them to worry about.
Nijjar's death sparked diplomatic tension after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Canada had intelligence linking India's government to the murder. India has previously denied the accusations. The fight over a gender identity policy in New Brunswick schools is escalating. One school district in Moncton is attempting to forge its own path, and now the district and the province are going to the courts over it. As Jacques Poitras reports, the education minister is threatening to dissolve the district's governing body over the dispute.
It is kind of disappointing just to see that it's not in a place where I would hope it would be.
Emmanuel Jackson has been following the battle over New Brunswick's Policy 713 for a year now. Jackson identifies as non-binary and was a member of her high school's Gender and Sexuality Alliance.
It's really important for the kids in our schools to feel safe and protected, and that's part of their right to education, I think.
Last year's changes to the policy require school staff to get parental consent. If a student under 16 wants to use a name or pronoun in line with their gender identity at school. Critics say that violates equality provisions of the Charter of Rights. Some district education councils agree and have adopted their own policies to give students more leeway to make their own choices. The province has demanded the repeal of those local policies.
To me, the trust is not there anymore.
Michel Côté is the chair of the province's largest Francophone school district. He says the provincial Progressive Conservative government is intruding in district decision-making.
It seems like the government is creating obstacle, leading us away from the main issue, which is the success of the students.
One Anglophone council in Moncton has gone to court, asking a judge for an injunction to block the education minister from repealing its policy. Minister Bill Hogan has not spoken publicly this week, but said last fall he was confident the province would prevail.
I personally believe that we're in the right. We're on the right side of this question. We're on the right side of this issue. And that the court will rule in our favor.
This week, Hogan ordered the Moncton District Council to stop spending money on its legal challenge. It refused. Now, Hogan says he will file a court application to dissolve the council, the first time a New Brunswick minister has attempted that.
We're kind of in uncharted territory here.
University of New Brunswick law professor Paul Warchuk says it's unclear how the courts would rule.
This raises that sort of classic dilemma. What happens when your boss tells you to do something that you think is unlawful?
On Friday, a judge said she'll hear the council's injunction request in June. She said the chaos over who sets policy can't continue and must be resolved before the new school year starts in September. New Brunswick voters will get their say, too, in a provincial election scheduled for October. Jacques Poitras, CBC News, Fredericton.
Still ahead on the podcast, many Canadians say their grocery bills have become unmanageable. Some frustrated shoppers are so angry, they're boycotting Loblaws for the month of May. The federal industry minister says he's looking outside of Canada for a new player to shake up the industry. What are the challenges? And most importantly, will it help? That story is coming up on Your World Tonight. What do New York, Venice, and Jakarta all have in common? They're all historically important, culturally significant, tourist hotspots. They're also all sinking. Jakarta is sinking so rapidly, it could be submerged by 2050. So the Indonesian government is taking extraordinary measures, building a new capital city from scratch. Freelance reporter Peter Hadfield has more.
In one of the fastest sinking areas of central Jakarta, the owner of a roadside restaurant told me she had been flooded several times, and the last time, the few customers she got had been trapped by rising water. But she remained surprisingly confident that all that was behind her. I think the government will take care of it because they've already hired people to come and fix the problem, she said. They're cleaning a canal which will allow the water to flow away. A few blocks away, in a quieter residential area, people were even more dismissive of the dangers. The engineers say the land here is sinking about 15 centimetres every year. Have you heard about this?
No. Bullshit.
Bullshit. You don't believe that.
So I do research about the flood risk management.
Nurul Fajad Januriadi is a professor at Pertamina University. He cites a couple of reasons Jakarta is being swallowed by the sea. The first is that the city gets its fresh water from wells, depleting underground aquifers. The other...
Another thing also, the sea level is increased.
When asked why many Jakartans aren't worried about their sinking city, Januriadi only offers this explanation.
So maybe Indonesian people is, is...
Optimistic?
Optimistic, maybe.
In January, outgoing President Joko Widodo revived plans to build a giant seawall to protect Jakarta. The mega project would take decades to construct and cost in excess of $14 billion.
So that's why, you know, you can see the sea basically, you know, just...
It's flooding.
Flooding slowly and slowly every year.
In a poor region of North Jakarta, a seawall that's supposed to act as protection is instead leaking the ocean into the area. Paul Dutoit is with the Think City Initiative. His organization can't do much about the sinking city or the crumbling infrastructure, but it can inform people about what's happening with colorful murals painted on empty buildings to explain why their neighborhood is slowly being abandoned to the sea.
And what does this represent?
You can see some buildings also representing the city and some waves that are just taking the city collapsing.
The new capital, called Nusantara, is being built from the ground up, about 1,200 kilometres away on the island of Borneo. The planned city should be inaugurated this August. Jakarta, and millions of people unwilling or unable to relocate, will be left to their fates. For CBC News, I'm Peter Hadfield in Jakarta.
Talks for reaching a global plastic pollution treaty wrapped this week in Ottawa. Progress was made, but negotiators still seem far apart on a final deal. One issue of contention: putting a cap on plastic production. That's led to some disappointment for people like Karen Wersig with the group Environmental Defense. She says the only way to reduce plastic pollution is to stop it at its source.
Everybody understands that the only way to stop this devastation is to cut plastic production. We're not going to stop pollution at the end of the pipe, right? We're never going to be able to clean up this problem through recycling and waste management.
Anand Ram was at those talks in Ottawa. He told us why recycling alone can't solve the world's plastic problems.
So what is this treaty trying to achieve?
So the phrase we heard over and over is that it's trying to address the full life cycle of plastic. And, well, what you just heard is a sense of exasperation because the beginning of that life, plastic production, doesn't seem like it's going to get addressed in this treaty, which ultimately is trying to get a binding agreement for more than 170 nations so that those nations can use it to say, hey, this is how we do something about plastic pollution. But after this week in Ottawa, which was supposed to be the second-to-last meeting to hammer out this treaty, everyone left knowing there's so much more work to do. And talking to experts over the last few weeks, you get a sense of how complex the problem of plastic is.
And that problem seems to start with even just the basic nature of plastic, right?
Absolutely.
What's the issue there?
So we think of plastics as this one category, you know, plastic bags, plastic containers, hard plastic, soft plastic, but no two pieces of packaging are the same. And researchers in Norway recently found that there are as many as 16,000 additives that go into making plastic.
Whoa.
And the world makes a lot, more than 460 million tons annually, most of which end up as waste. And all those chemicals means you can't recycle everything the same way. You know, there's a term, wish cycling, where you toss something into your recycling hoping that it'll be taken care of properly.
Oh, that's hitting a little close to home.
Absolutely. I think everyone can relate to that. But, you know, the data shows only 9% of plastic gets recycled. And the problem is partly the lack of how it gets sorted. Here's Emily Robinson at the University of Guelph.
A lot of variation in standardization of recycling across the country. Like, you know, I'm in Guelph right now, and Waterloo, which is a neighboring municipality, has completely different standards on what goes into the blue box. So that lack of standardization causes a lot of consumer confusion around where things are supposed to go. And it causes a lot of contamination in the system.
Okay, so if there are all of these problems around recycling, why do we keep doing it? I mean, recycling has been around for a really long time. We've been trying to do it for a long time. If it's not working, why continue?
Absolutely. I think people are waking up to that in the sense that, you know, these sort of figures that I'm saying, they're starting to come more into focus. But the plastics industry, who were very much in attendance at this week's negotiations in Ottawa, they advocate for recycling as the solution, lobbying for things like advanced methods of recycling, design changes so products are more recyclable. You know, Coca-Cola told CBC News that it wants to make all of its products recyclable by next year. Again, not that they will be recycled, just that they can be. Coca-Cola products, by the way, recently topped the list again of the most common brand found in an audit of nearly 2 million plastic waste items collected by volunteers. But again, to this idea of wish cycling, to some experts, it's because we ship the problem away, out of sight, out of mind. Countries that accept plastic waste from us, they have economies, both formal and informal, that depend on waste pickers. Advocates tell us that it's a dangerous business that can end up creating more toxic problems for communities. But, you know, they need the money. So in some sense, if they need the money, we're happy to provide.
What does this mean for the future of plastics?
It's daunting to think about. I mean, we've just talked about chemical complexity, waste management standards issues, labor force concerns, and we haven't even touched on the various health impacts of these microplastics that we're finding around the world and even in our bodies. The future is, if we don't deal with this now, the problem will grow. The same estimates that say that we create 460 million tons of plastic say that it's going to be more than a billion tons by the year 2060. But that's what this treaty is trying to tackle. Even if it can't be as ambitious as limiting production, where all this plastic begins, there's hope that by the time this gets to the final round of negotiations in Busan, South Korea in November, it makes regulations that are enforceable throughout the world.
Okay, Anand, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Canada is in the market for a new international player on the grocery store scene. It's an effort to bring more competition into a heavily consolidated grocery sector and lower prices for consumers. But analysts say bringing in a foreign supermarket won't be a piece of cake. Jenna Bentetrit explains.
I've said it, and I continue, is to look at whether there would be foreign deep discounters that would be interested in the Canadian market.
Canadians are still struggling with high grocery bills, so attracting an international supermarket is high on the federal industry minister's shopping list. François-Philippe Champagne is reportedly asking low-cost European and U.S. chains to compete with Canadian giants like Loblaw, Sobeys, and Metro.
It's a bit of a tough sell.
Concordia University food marketing professor Jordan LaBelle says a foreign grocer will have to navigate a tricky Canadian marketplace.
Looking at Canada, it's a huge territory. You have to concentrate your operations around key cities. Is that enough to justify an international expansion?
But that's not the only challenge. Almost three quarters of grocery stores in Canada are owned by just five brands. They have established relationships with their suppliers and loyalty programs for their customers, LaBelle says.
Really what we're seeing here is lip service to try to attract international player.
Welcome to your Aldi store. It's about shopping smart. Shop.
German deep discount darling Aldi could be on Champagne's list. It's now one of the fastest growing grocers in the U.S. The brand didn't respond when asked if it had plans to come to Canada, but it wouldn't be the first time we've mingled with international grocers. U.S. grocery chain Safeway was a mainstay in Western provinces, but they sold their operations to Sobeys. Target came to Canada in 2013 with groceries supplied by Sobeys, only to die 2 years later. Walmart Canada has succeeded because of the company's well-oiled system. The company revolutionized wide-scale logistics and distribution, says market analyst Kevin Greer.
The lessons that they learned in the United States, they carried them over into Canada.
Another alternative to big chains are independent stores and food co-ops. Gary Sands of the Canadian Federation of Independent Grocers hopes the government will keep its focus on Canada.
We'd like them to sit down and talk about our list instead of going off, trotting off to France or somewhere else in Europe.
The minister says he's not sure if he'll succeed in bringing a foreign grocer to Canada, but says it's definitely worth the effort. Jenna Benchetrit, CBC News, Toronto.
In the NHL playoffs, it's Game 7 for two of the original six. The Toronto Maple Leafs are hoping for victory tonight against the Boston Bruins, and Leafs fans are hyped.
I'm fired up for Game 7, and all I know, we got momentum now. Leafs in 7!
Meanwhile, two other Canadian teams are vying for the title of best in the West. The Vancouver Canucks and the Edmonton Oilers will face off in round two tomorrow. That series is already heating up off the ice. The BC and Alberta premiers even have a bet going where the loser has to deliver a statement in the legislature written by the winner while wearing their jersey. Greg Ross is covering it all for us from Toronto. Greg, let's talk Leafs, who have been in this very position with this very team before. How are things looking against the Bruins compared to past matchups?
Well, I'll tell you what, you could see the tension in the air just on the players' faces before this game. There's no doubt about it. They know the magnitude of this one. There's five players on this Leaf roster who have been around for the past 7-8 years. And these players have seen some huge disappointment at the hands of the Boston Bruins. This is actually the fourth time that they're playing in a first-round series since 2013. The Leafs have lost the previous three, including in 2017 and 2018, and players like Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, William Nylander, John Tavares, they were all around, and they suffered those losses. All those series went to Game 7. So there's a lot on the line. The Leafs are hoping to change history with a victory over the Bruins in this Game 7. And what a difference a week can make. Remember, the Leafs, at the beginning of this week, were trailing 3-1 in this series, and with their backs up against the wall, managed to come up with two huge victories, one in Boston and then one Thursday night on home ice. William Nylander, the hero in that game. We'll see if he can have a repeat performance tonight in Game 7 in Boston, the Leafs having to win a big one on the road tonight.
Ooh, so you mentioned Leafs top scorer there, Austin Matthews. He is back with the team. He's playing. That was a big question mark going into this game. What does his presence do for the energy of the team? How significant is it?
Well, I mean, let's face it. I mean, he's their leading scorer. He had 69 goals this season. That's a team record for the Toronto Maple Leafs. His offense is a huge part of this team, but he missed the last couple of games of this series with an undisclosed illness. The Leafs wouldn't tell us exactly what was wrong with Matthews other than to say that when he exerted himself, it got worse. But after sitting out those two games, Matthews skated with the team this morning at their morning skate, and he is on the ice for the Leafs in this Game 7. We'll see how he holds up. We'll see if that illness is still lingering, if it's still bothering. But right now, just his presence in the lineup is big news for the players on the team, and it's big news for the fans as well, who are excited to have their best player back in the lineup, Stephanie.
All right, Greg Ross in Toronto, thank you so much. We are in the midst of a 5-day celebration of East Coast music at the East Coast Music Awards. And here is one of the highlights, the East Pointers. The modern folk group from PEI led the nominations. And with this year's festival being held in Charlottetown, they're on home turf to celebrate their win for Group Recording of the Year. Another big win for a PEI-born star, Jen Grant, scooped up Songwriter of the Year. While Halifax alt-pop duo Neon Dreams has won Album of the Year for Love Child Baby Dolphin. Those are some of the awards that have already been handed out, but there is more to come in the final ceremony tomorrow. The music that's been feted so far is an indication of just how much musical talent there is in Atlantic Canada, even after people from the East Coast leave. Just take this year's Fans' Choice of the Year, the Darina Harvey Band, whose members are from Newfoundland but are now based in Edmonton. We'll leave you with more of the Darina Harvey Band's ode to their East Coast roots. This is Waves of Home on Your World Tonight. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. Good night.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.